Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Sweet. Marcus, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can. How are you doing this afternoon?
I am pretty well, thanks. How are you?
Not too bad. Sweet. So let's get right into it. So our first story this week is around pregnancy and COVID-19 and what threats are posed to pregnant women. So what risk does COVID-19 pose to pregnant women?
So after about a year of pandemic, data are finally coming in on this topic and whether there's a risk to the mother or to the baby. And the good news is that babies are mostly spared any severe respiratory infection, don't really get sick, or at least they don't often get sick. But unfortunately, the rates of severe illness and death are higher in pregnant women, and especially from certain minority racial and ethnic groups. And so this is obviously a big concern, and a bunch of questions still remain. So researchers really want to know how widespread COVID-19 infection is amongst pregnant women overall, because the majority of the data are collected from women who end up in hospital for any reason during their pregnancy. And they're studying whether women are more vulnerable to getting viral infections or the repercussions in any particular phase of pregnancy or during postpartum recovery. And in particular, there's a sort of a void of data that's only just being filled on the dangers to pregnant women. There's also a gap around vaccination safety. Following sort of established sort of normal behavior, none of the major vaccine makers enrolled pregnant women in their vaccine trials. So it was unclear what the effect was of the vaccines on pregnant women and their babies. But as health systems began to sort of start churning out around the world, began to churn out shots, so regulators have offered sort of often conflicting or vague recommendations about whether pregnant women should be offered a vaccination jab. The World Health Organization has recommended that the messenger RNA vaccines, those are the ones made by Moderna and Pfizer, and Pfizer is the one New Zealand has bought, they may be offered only to pregnant women at highest risk. That's those working in frontline positions or with existing health conditions and after consultations with their physicians. But it was later added in clarifying language that said the vaccines pose no known specific risks in pregnancy. But because of the lack of data, the WHO couldn't provide any broad recommendations for vaccination of pregnant women. But overwhelmingly, I think physicians would recommend that pregnant women be offered the vaccine after consultation. And it's not really surprising. So the prenatal risks are not particularly surprising because viruses tend to pose a threat to women whose lungs are already working harder than usual. As the uterus grows, it pushes up against the diaphragm and it reduces lung capacity. So it makes it... increases the stress on the respiratory system. On top of that, pregnancy dials down the immune system so as not to harm the baby. And that makes women quite a lot more susceptible to complications from infection. So, for example, influenza, as an example, pregnant women who catch it are much higher risk of hospitalization compared with women who are not pregnant. Another question is whether if a mother contracts COVID-19, will her baby be affected? Because obviously, if preterm infection can lead to early deliveries and could potentially lead to long-term consequences for the baby. But studies published only just a couple of months ago showed that this vertical transmission from mother to unborn baby was rare. And in a small study, 62 pregnant women who tested positive for COVID found no evidence of virus in the blood or the cord blood of the babies that that were tested, and none of the 48 babies that were swabbed tested positive for the virus when they were born.
That is so interesting. I was going to say, yeah. It's just interesting to understand, like, so much we still don't understand about how we work, how this virus works, how, I mean, we do understand how the vaccines are working, but just the new technology that's come out with it since the start of the pandemic.
Yeah, that's right. And because everything has had to move so quickly, you know, these vaccines have been improved in super short periods of time. Not everything is known about their safety, and it is concerning that they don't understand what the effect of the vaccine is on pregnancy and unborn babies.
Okay, so moving on to our next topic for today, we're talking about nuclear energy 10 years after Fukushima and the tsunami that happened in Japan. So what does the future look like for nuclear energy going forward?
Yeah, so it's been 10 years since that massive earthquake caused meltdowns in several of the reactors in Fukushima, and it triggered the worst accident since Chernobyl in the mid-80s. And a decade afterwards, there's still serious questions lingering about the safety of nuclear power, and also the sort of the feasibility of nuclear power to solve our climate crisis. So a lot of people say nuclear power is an inevitable choice if the planet is going to limit global warming, but there are still significant environmental and especially social concerns that lead others to be more circumspect and oppose nuclear power. There's a lot of questions still about safety and the cost as challenges for the nuclear industry. But there's still larger problems. The industry itself is still somewhat inward-looking and opaque. And often the way the nuclear sector has made long-term technology and policy decisions haven't sort of gone a lot of support amongst the communities in which the reactors and the industry operates. So there's a couple of big questions concerning the future of the industry. So the first is, you know, will the sector ever overcome public disapproval? There is a lot, nuclear power is very polarizing, and a lot of people are very, very strongly opposed to nuclear power. And so there's a big question about whether the sector can sort of clean up its image and overcome that disapproval. And second, the benefits, are the benefits really worth the risks and the costs to people and the environment? Nuclear power is touted as this clean energy source, but in fact, you know, the accidents have caused tremendous environmental damage, a tremendous social upheaval, and the mining of the nuclear fuels and the disposal of the nuclear fuels still present a really big problem for the industry. When nuclear power started, it seemed unstoppable in the 50s and 60s. Policymakers expected that nuclear power would become dominant and almost too cheap to even meter. But in the 80s and 90s, there was this very, very sharp, after Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, which was in the late 70s, a big accident in the States, there was a sharp decline in the industry and in investment. While projections from the 70s by the Atomic Energy Agency predicted about 12 or 13% of the world's electricity generating capacity, or even 15% by the year 2000, in reality, it was only about, by the year 2000, it was only about a third of that was predicted. And then came this big accident in Fukushima, and immediately, or very, very quickly afterwards, countries like Germany and Switzerland basically voted to phase out nuclear energy altogether. In Japan, of the 54 reactors operational at the time of the accident, 12 were subsequently permanently closed, and 24 still to this day remain shuttered, basically not operating. In the States, there was a big review of nuclear power, A lot of safety concerns were raised, but the country does still remain committed to nuclear power. So today, about 50 nuclear reactors are being constructed in about 16 countries. China leads the 16 plants underway, with India and South Korea also building a lot. And at the end of February, or last month, there were worldwide 414 reactors running in 32 countries, contributing about 10% of the world's electricity supply. But it's deeper than just a sort of a basic safety issue. There's a very deep social issue. Much of the support for nuclear energy focuses almost exclusively on its sort of technical and economic characteristics, but there are definitely unresolved moral and ethical concerns. There is a large swell of people who are left out of decision-making processes about where to build nuclear reactors. Nearly three quarters of uranium produced globally comes from mines that are in or near indigenous communities, for example, in the US and Australia. And a lot of these mines left unremediated after use have poisoned lands and peoples and upended traditional ways of life. And the nuclear sector has consistently failed to engage meaningfully with the public over these sort of concerns. And if nuclear energy is going to have sort of a meaningful role in decarbonization and in addressing climate change, people and perspectives that up till now have been excluded from the design and the development and the policy making processes really must start to have a seat at the table. If you compare it to other industries like the solar industry that's grown hugely in the last 10 or 20 years, in the mining of lithium for batteries that's in everyone's phone, they could be facing similar issues, but those industries have tended to engage much more respectfully with the local peoples and the policymakers, and don't face the same sort of issues that the nuclear industry faces. So there's still big challenges ahead for that industry.
Okay, and moving on to our final topic, which Anika is going to take on board, we're talking about ancient Earth. And it being underwater.
Having a lot more water than we previously thought. So how does this differ from previous hypotheses about our ancient Earth?
Well, apparently, and I didn't realize this, that it was, until fairly recently, it was not clear how much water was on Earth 3 or 4 billion years ago. But there's evidence that's coming to light that, in fact, there was enough water so that the planet's oceans were about twice as full as today. And if we put twice as much water in the oceans that we currently have, there would be enough water to submerge every continent above the peak of Mount Everest. So basically, the world would just be covered with water. And so this is obviously, so the question is, in 3 billion or 3 or 4 billion years, where on Earth did all that water go? Because it's not here now. And it's not sort of encased in ice in the polar region. So evidence comes from this comes from rocks in the mantle. So this is the thick layer of rock beneath the crust. This region of the Earth's interior is very, very warm. But early in Earth's history, it was about four times hotter than it is today. And experiments using hydraulic presses to sort of simulate the pressures and the temperatures that were existing back, in that period, suggest that the water that today is sort of part of the rock, so it actually forms part of the crystal structure of part of the rock itself. That water at four times the temperature, the rock was not able to hold it. And so when temperatures were warmer, when the pressures were maybe a little higher, the mantle itself was unable to hold as much water as it does today. And so that water was available and present on the surface. And so this evidence is supported by other evidence from titanium concentrations in crystals that are 4 billion years old in Western Australia that are thought to have formed underwater. And there were other rock formations, 3 and 4 billion year old rock formations in Australia and Greenland that contain rocks that can only form as magma cools underwater. And so it seems like as the Earth has cooled over the last 3 or 4 billion years, thankfully, the water that was present has been sort of absorbed by the rocks and actually forms part of the rock itself now. And so we're not all swimming. And it's just a reminder that how sort of conditional Earth's evolution has been. Right at the start, when Earth was formed, the planet was probably very parched and very dry, and the water came from asteroids that actually were water rich and bombarded it shortly after its birth. And if the asteroids had deposited maybe twice as much water, or the present day mantle had less of an appetite for water, then the continents which we live on and are so essential for life on Earth would really never have emerged. So it's a really very delicate system. Too much water or too little water, and this whole planet we live on really wouldn't be a good place for life.
That's just so interesting. Thank you so much for that, Marcus.
You're very welcome.
Sweet. And we'll talk to you again in another 2 weeks. See you then.
Hopefully in person. Yeah, see you then.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed. Cheers.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.